on BCFM.
BCFM 93.2.
Is this Paul Lambert?
It is.
Oh, hello. I'm writing an important paper, and I heard you were a member of this club called Skull and Bones.
I don't have a comment on that. Our membership is private. The membership is private, and I really can't tell you whether I am or I'm not.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh. But maybe you can tell me, how do you get into Skull and Bones then?
I can't talk about it.
Or how did it all start?
I can't tell you.
Is there anything you can tell me?
No. I don't mean to be unfriendly, but that's our policy. It's policy of the organization, and so I really, I'm not at liberty to violate it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Worse than Honduras, Trump's verdict on the city of Baltimore. Trump says the city's corrupt, but the mayor of the Democrat-run city, Baltimore, Elijah Cummings, says it's just more evidence the president's a racist. Plus, the president of Israel this week. Who is he? Reuven Rivlin. And what does he think about changing the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem? Meanwhile, Israeli army cadets are released in Cyprus after accusation they gang-raped a British girl. Apparently, it was her fault. And in a Mexican cafe, Israeli mafia shootings leave two dead. Plus, the invasion of Afghanistan back in 2001. Crikey, all that time ago. That was 9/11 year, wasn't it? Still going strong. The only trouble is the occupying NATO forces are killing more civilians than the so-called indigenous enemy. The Taliban. Is it time to go home? Or is the West's continuing presence there just a rather thin excuse for colonialism and a way of intimidating Russia and Iran next door? Talking about Iran, Javad Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, is personally sanctioned by the United States. Will it make any difference? And by the way, when will the Grace 1 tanker be released? The one in Gibraltar, the Iranian one, remember that? Evidence this week that Gibraltar changed the law the day before the tanker was boarded in international waters to make the piracy illegal, at least by the new Gibraltar laws. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week we're walking straight out of school in Whitchurch, age 16, and into an aerospace job at Filton. That was life in Bristol in the 1970s. We hear from Steve McHenry, who did it, what it was like, and then from US political analyst Anton Chaitkin about why the US and Britain have been deindustrialised by the oligarchy. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday. Or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. To start, Martin, we have to have a look at the United States sanctioning the Iranian foreign minister. I mean, what's this all about? What is this? Well, this is a recent thing, isn't it? They've done it with the Russians too. People like Vladimir Putin's personal friends now get American sanctions specifically on them as individuals.
Well, it's silly, really, because they're saying that they want to negotiate with the Iranians, but we won't negotiate with the main Iranian negotiator, which means that, I mean, the Iranians have basically said, well, you're not serious about talking to us, so don't even talk about it. We're beyond talking to you behind the scenes.
It's a bit like when you're having a discussion with somebody about a topic and then they suddenly turn personal and they say, actually, this is not really about the topic we're discussing, it's about you as a specific individual. You are the problem.
Well, I mean, there have been sanctions on Iran since 1979, when they overthrew the Shah, to the displeasure of the Americans and the Israelis and the British. So the Iranians are quite used to being sanctioned. It's not something that surprises them. And as a result, they've developed all kinds of mechanisms for coping with not being able to trade properly, and so on and so forth. But they're not going to change. I mean, there's nothing they can do that would make the Americans happy, to be honest. The Americans just want regime change in Iran. That's not going to happen. So the Iranians are just digging into to carry. I mean, the real danger is that some foolish escalation is going to lead us all into a major war.
So who's driving this regime change? Is it the United States? Is it Britain? Is it Israel? Who's behind it?
Well, Israel have been pretty clear that they want regime change in Iran, and Sheldon Adelson in the United States, who's a big supporter of Israel and also the biggest funder of US politics, is on record saying we should just nuke Iran. Turn it into a glass car park, I think was his comment. So that's what they're saying. The Iranians can speak perfectly good English, the leadership.
They know they can hear
all of this. And they go, well, OK, we can see where you're coming from. There's not much incentive for us to negotiate with you about anything, really.
Martin, what's in it for America?
Well, they don't like Iranians anyway. This developing axis between China, Russia, and Iran as a junior partner is basically what they regard as the empire of evil, although the other side regard them as the empire of evil. And they're basically, the idea is they want full spectrum dominance. You know, they want their people running Venezuela. They've got their people running Honduras, which we can come to in a minute, if you like.
Is it just because they don't do as they're told, the Iranians?
Yes, basically.
Israelis don't always do what they're told either, do they?
Well, I mean, the Iranians nationalised their oil industry in 1954 to the great displeasure of British Petroleum, which was run by the British government, and the Americans obligingly helped to overthrow the government of Mossadegh and then impose the Shah of Iran and his lovely secret police Savak for, you know, several decades. And the Iranians, of course, remember all of this. And, of course, most people in Britain and America do we overthrow the democratic government? I'm afraid we did, and of course that leaves the Iranians with a rather bad taste in
the
mouth.
Okay, well, the guy behind this is the US National Security Advisor John Bolton. At least he's the person who is the spokesperson for explaining why Javad Zarif has to be sanctioned. Who is this guy?
Bolton? Well, he's a long-term neocon. He banged the drum for war in Iraq. I mean, there isn't a war that he isn't keen to have, frankly. He's an extremely belligerent character.
The regime in Iran, which, after all, was designated by Ronald Reagan as a state sponsor of terror,
right.
That we regard his activities as sanctionable. We've frozen any assets he has in the United States. We've restricted his activities and those of people who do business with him. I think it's a very significant decision that the president made. We announced about a month ago we were going to do it. Now we're carrying through on it. And it sends a signal that we consider Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, an illegitimate spokesman for Iran. It is a state sponsor of terrorism. It is the world's central banker of terrorism, biggest financer, biggest armor, without any question. We've designated the Quds Force and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards right. Corps as terrorist organizations, and I think that shows we are concerned with more than just Iran's aspiration for nuclear weapons. We are watching those nuclear activities very, very closely. They remain under daily scrutiny. And it's certainly the case that nothing that we see that contributes in any way to the possibility of an Iran nuclear weapons capability are we going to permit. So this is a short 90-day extension. It's intended, as I say, to be under constant observation, and I just keep my eye on that spot.
So that's John Bolton there, National Security Advisor to Donald Trump. He's there saying, Martin, that Iran, and this is the reason that they've done this, is the central banker of world terrorism. And why on earth would they not want to sanction such a central banker of world terrorism?
Well, it's just overblown rhetoric. The Iranians have got their interests across the Middle East.
Well, they're saying it's not overblown rhetoric, that they are doing more financing of terrorism than anyone else on the planet.
I tell you who's doing more financing of terrorism than anybody else on the planet. The United States of America and Saudi Arabia, along with their friends, the British and the Israelis. And they've been financing terror, for example, in Syria, supporting the al-Nusra Front, the local branch of al-Qaeda. And Tulsi Gabbard was in the Democrat debate this week, and she was saying that Trump Trump is supporting Al-Qaeda. And of course, he is. That's what your tax dollars go for, folks. We're supposedly against Al-Qaeda, but in actual fact, we're financing them to overthrow the government of Syria, just as we financed them in Afghanistan in the 1980s. That relationship between the Saudi extremists, the Wahhabists, the real terrorists, the ones that carried out all of these extremist attacks inside Western Europe, we finance them. They are our allies, not the Iranians' allies.
If you don't agree
with
that point, you surely have to agree with John Bolton that Javid Zarif is not a legitimate spokesperson for the Iranian people, because they don't really want what he's trying to foist on the world.
Well, he's representing the elected government of Iran. When were the elections in Saudi Arabia? Who killed Khashoggi in the?
If you don't agree with that, what about these terrorist groups, the Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guard Corps?
They are a bit like RSAS. That's what they are. They are the Iranian version. Are they not allowed to have stuff like that? Maybe we should disband all of our special forces, the ones that are inside Syria at the moment, working with the enemies of the government and trying to overthrow the elected government of Syria. That's terrorism, isn't it?
But why are you comparing the SAS to, say, the Revolutionary Guard Corps? Who are the Quds Force?
Well, the exact configuration of the Iranian order of battle is an interesting one, and we could go into it, but all they've got is exactly the same sort of stuff we've got. And, of course, we support terrorism when it suits us, as we did in Afghanistan in the 1980s. We supported the Mujahideen to fight the Russians. Then they were called freedom fighters when we do it, and when other people do it back to us, they're terrorists. It's just words.
Also, the tanker business that started this off, the most recent round, in fact, was quite interesting to hear this week that the Gibraltar government actually changed the law in Gibraltar just the day before this tanker was seized. Now, Martin, what they're saying is that it was just basically there was no political motive. It does suggest that potentially, since the politicians changed the law in Gibraltar, that perhaps there was a political motive to seizing the Grace 1 tanker, the Iranian tanker, just off Gibraltar in international waters.
Well, of course. I mean, you think there's some politics involved in this, Tony? Of course there is. The Americans told the British to seize the tanker. They changed the... It was actually not registered as an Iranian tanker. It was actually registered in Panama. And in Panama, they told them to withdraw the registration. So it then became an Iranian tanker. And then the British were tipped off to seize it. So it's definitely a political manoeuvre by the deep state in the US to drag Britain into a confrontation with Iran.
I mean, some people
and
are saying...
Conservative politicians have gone along with it hook, line,
well,
and sinker.
On, because some people are saying this is a little parting gift of Jeremy Hunt to Boris.
Well, it's a little parting. We are basically going on about the sovereignty of Britain. Meanwhile, our policy is being decided in the United States, and the policy in the United States is being decided in Jerusalem.
So it wasn't Jeremy Hunt's decision. You think it was the American decision?
Jeremy Hunt was basically put in the picture by the American deep state. They fingered this tanker. They said, "Will you do this job for us?" And Jeremy Hunt said, "Yes, sir. No, sir. Three bags full, sir." That's what happened there.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Tom Bateman from the BBC talking to the captain of the Grace 1 tanker. He's an Indian guy who wants to remain anonymous.
They came up to the bridge and I asked them, "I'm the captain, what do you want?" They just pointed the gun and they started shouting, "Look forward, look forward." I said, "I'm the captain, tell me what do you want?" They just didn't listen to me. No, I was totally shocked. I didn't know what to feel because they didn't give me a chance to talk. They didn't care whether I was master or nobody, nothing. There was no regulations followed. We are 28th unarmed crew. You know, I was in a state of shock. Everybody was in a state of shock. I was trying to talk to them. They were not communicating.
And when you say no, when you say no regulations were followed, in what sense?
Yeah, I mean, how do you come on a ship like this with armed forces and with such brute force? For what reason? You've suspected the vessel is carrying oil. All you need to do to arrest a ship is the harbour master comes on board or sends. He says, "Captain, give me your certificate file. You have been arrested." That's all that needs to be done. I don't know why so much force was used. I don't understand.
During the voyage, the captain said he was initially told to give estimated time of arrival reports for Syria. He said they plotted a course to Banyas, but only because it was in the centre of the coastline. Now, he claims the supertanker is too big to port there and said the destination reports were later changed to Cyprus. I put it to him that he could have known whether there was anything illegitimate about his ship.
Well, as far as I go, I know that I've done the right thing. I have followed company procedures. Also, I came to know from my lawyers that on the 3rd, the local laws in Gibraltar were changed to facilitate the arrest of this vessel. So this was a big game, basically.
Well, that is a reference to a Gibraltar regulation issued the day before, which gave the territory the power to detain any ship likely to be in breach of EU regulations. Gibraltar denies the raid was disproportionate. Its police force said last night the operation involved minimum force required to ensure safe boarding. Gibraltar has also said it wasn't acting at anyone's political behest. It says this was an independent action based purely on applying the law, and it says it has evidence that entirely contradicts the captain's statements, in particular relating to the Banyas oil refinery.
Well, as his captain said there, he was saying that the ship's too big to go to Banyas, but I don't know whether that's true or not. The fact of the matter is that the Iranians are perfectly entitled to send oil to Syria by any mechanism they want. The EU sanctions are only for EU countries. They're not for other countries. Other countries don't have to abide by EU sanctions. And isn't it extraordinary, at the same time as all conservative politicians are banging on about we're leaving the EU, the EU sanctions are going to... And then, of course, the Spanish didn't get involved. They didn't get involved. And they weren't involved in any of this, because they've got a socialist government in Spain who probably would have just said, no, we're not going to do
this. It's not just the Spanish, it's the whole of the European Union have been very silent about this whole business, haven't they?
That's right. So what's happened here, this is definitely political. It's a mechanism by which the British in particular are being peeled away from the EU position of no sanctions on Iran and let's get the nuclear deal back up and running. That is the general position, that's also the British position. But by doing this, we've now got ourselves in a position where the Iranians don't trust us, and the Americans are giving us a pat on the back for being such good little bulldogs.
Well, what about Javad Zarif? I go back to him again, and the Iranian foreign minister, because he was interviewed by Zainab Badawi on the BBC's Hard Talk a couple of weeks ago. He had a little quote a couple of weeks ago about that, but let's have a listen again to that, a little bit of that interview on the BBC with the guy who's now been sanctioned by the Americans, specifically and personally.
We are under sanctions from the United States. Their objective is to bring our oil sales to zero. That is why we will do whatever we can to avoid the United States knowing what we are doing. One more thing. The United Kingdom, by taking our ship, by confiscating our ship, is helping the United States imposing its illegal oil sanctions against Iran. It's nothing about EU sanctions against Syria. It's about Iran. That is why John Bolton thanked Great Britain for giving them the best 4th of July presents possible.
Maybe John Bolton heard that interview and got so annoyed he decided to sanction the guy.
Well, he's that petty. He's a rather petty individual, and it's quite likely that that's probably what's going on. It's a really poor policy.
But at the end of the day, surely the United States has not got the leverage in Europe to get the European countries to do their dirty work for them.
Yeah, but they've got the leverage here in Britain because we're sovereign and we're about to leave the EU. We're a sovereign country, but we will just do anything they say. The Germans, the French and the Spanish will just tell them to get lost, but we don't.
Also, this week, I thought I'd have a look at the Israeli president. Do you know who he is, Martin?
No.
It's funny, isn't it?
Because he's a rather minor figure in the politics of the country. He's a rather figurehead figure.
Yes, but, surely, as president, he's got quite a powerful role.
He's a country the size of Wales, Tony. You can't keep up with everything.
Okay, fair enough. So, anyway, his name is Reuven Rivlin, and here he is getting very excited about the move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv, which is the Israeli capital, to Jerusalem, which the Zionists and many Israelis also want to be the capital in the long term. Before we hear that, Martin, though, what is the issue here? Why shouldn't Jerusalem be the capital of the Jewish state? It seems a no-brainer.
Well, the borders of Israel, as decided in 1948... did not include Jerusalem, and even after 1967, when the Israelis seized further land, including East Jerusalem, the general policy of the outside world was that Jerusalem was going to be a basically not part of either state, but an international city in which the Palestine would have its capital in their bit of it.
But why can't the Muslims, say, have Mecca as their capital, the Christians, say, have, I don't know, Bethlehem or somewhere as their capital, and the Jews have Jerusalem to themselves?
Because since 1648, modern states aren't based on religion, they're supposedly based on sovereignty, which is what we're talking about in terms of Brexit and everything else, and you can't just say we're going to have it. You can't.
Okay, so since 1648, what was that?
Well, there's a Treaty of Westphalia which created the modern state system. And, of course, the Muslims of the world are broken up into all sorts of different states. There's not one Muslim state, just as there isn't one Christian state.
Interesting. Anton Chaikin talks about that on Dialect next Tuesday at noon, which I mentioned at the top of the hour. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Israeli President Reuven Rivlin talking about the move at the point of the move of the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Members of the distinguished delegation coming from the United States, our chief rabbis, ministers and members of Knesset, head of the opposition, commissioner of the police, head of the Mossad, Mayor Neil Barkat, ambassador, distinguished guests. Omdot hayu Ragleinu. Our feet were standing within your gates, in the gates of Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Jerusalem, whose faith we swore to keep. Jerusalem, who we never forgot and never will forget. For 3,000 years, the Jewish people kept their faith in Jerusalem. For 3,000 years, we prayed for Jerusalem. And since the establishment of the State of Israel 70 years ago, Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel. And the obvious, as President Trump has said, the obvious should be set from time to time, even could be written from time to time. Jerusalem is the heart of sovereignty of the State of Israel. Yes, President Trump, Jerusalem is home to the President of Israel. Jerusalem is home to the government of Israel. Jerusalem is home to the Knesset, the parliament of Israel. Jerusalem is home to the Supreme Court of Israel. The state of Israel's commitment to Jerusalem is not only a commitment to the history of the Jewish people, but is also a commitment to all residents in Jerusalem. All the Jerusalemites. Jerusalem is a microcosm of our ability, Jews and Arabs, to live together. The unity of Jerusalem is also seen in that all living in the city are equal. And as of this happy day, Jerusalem is also the embassy to Israel of the United States of America. Thanks God.
Well, you can see the note of triumphalism there. The legal position is that it's not the capital of Israel. The only people who recognise that effectively are the Americans.
But surely if the Prime Minister and the President say it's the capital, it's the capital.
Well, they've taken the land around Jerusalem, and they've created all these suburbs around the outside of it. They're trying to basically take over the West Bank, and they've annexed the Golan Heights. But that's not recognised in international law, any more than Serbia's right to control Kosovo is recognised in international law, even though the Serbian nation was created in Kosovo. And it was but the whole creation of a modern Serbian state from the Middle Ages was after the Battle of Kosovo-Polju. But of course, today, it's got a Muslim majority and they can't have it.
But if the Jews have been praying for Jerusalem to be restored to them for 3,000 years, surely it's about time it happened.
Well, I can pray for the Serbs to get control of Kosovo, but we fought a 73-day war against them, killing 10,000 people. We were on the other side.
Serbia is not one of the great faiths, is it?
Well, their Orthodox faith is very important to them, and they actually were in control of Kosovo until very recently. You know, about 100, 150 years ago, they lost the majority in Kosovo. So they've got more right to Kosovo than the Israelis or the Jews from all over the world have got to Israel. I mean, the Jews all over the world live all over the world.
I think maybe...
They haven't got a right to take the land off the people who are there already.
Maybe events are overtaking you, Martin, because surely Jerusalem is very soon going to be declared the capital.
It's been declared a capital by the Israelis. It's been recognised by the US, but it hasn't even been recognised by Saudi Arabia, who are their close allies. Nobody else is going to recognise it, just as nobody else is going to recognise Republika Srpska. Ultimately, these are questions about war. This is what the First World War was all about. Who gets to do what? And it's all very well claiming that we've got God on our side because we pray. Well, the other side pray as well, and they believe it's theirs. So that'll have to be settled by force then, won't it?
Also, in Mexico, there's been a shootout this week in a Mexican cafe where two Israeli mafia people were shot. Now, this is not the sort of thing you'd expect to be going on in Mexico. Why is it happening in Mexico and not over in Israel?
Well, the international criminal underworld, which is interlinked with the intelligence world, functions globally. So, you know, it's quite possible that Israeli mafia are going to be in Mexico because they're probably up to their eyeballs in drug dealing like the rest of the Mexican mafia.
What's the main activities then of the mafia over in Mexico, and why is
as you well know, it's the international drugs trade which is causing major problems. I mean, it's a major a money spinner for them, but then there's all sorts of violent activities that go on around it, creating huge problems, and that's presumably part of that.
Two Israeli men were shot dead in an apparent Mexico City shopping mall hit, news agency Reuters said. This is on Thursday, latest flare-up of violence convulsing the capital. Mexico City police said a woman and a man opened fire on the Israelis on Wednesday afternoon in a restaurant in the upscale Plaza Arts Pedregal in the southwest of the capital and then fled. The Israeli embassy in Mexico identified the men as Alon Azulay, 41, and Benjamin Yesurun Suchi, 44. Both had criminal records in Mexico and Israel. Officers later arrested the woman, identified by Mexican media as 33-year-old Esperanza Gutierrez. This was to commit a homicide. There was no other reason. That much is clear to us, Ulises Lara, a spokesman for state prosecutors in Mexico City, told a news conference. Lara noted the evidence suggested in the shooting was linked to disputes between criminal groups with connections to the Israeli mafia.
Well, that's right. All of these things are, these things are international, but they're also linked in with intelligence operations of various kinds, like the Iran-Contra affair, where cocaine was being imported into the United States in order to fund conspiracy in Nicaragua.
We know about the Italian mafia, but not so much about the Israeli mafia. How powerful are they in the world?
Meyer Lansky was the head of the mafia in the US for many years, the top guy. And of course, not all Israelis are mafiosi, and not all Jews are Zionists, but some of them are. And of course, the Semyon Mogilevich in Russia, the head of the mafia in Russia, is of Jewish extraction and has Israeli citizenship. And of course, all of these linkages are, they've got linkages into the banking community and so on. That's not to accuse all Jews of being mafiosi. That would be absurd. We don't accuse all Italians of being mafiosi, but there are plenty of mafia from all walks of life around the world, and they're working closely with intelligence services because they've got shared interests.
The Israelis, this is in Cyprus now, have been held over an alleged rape, have been freed as the British accuser is arrested. A 19-year-old UK tourist is now to appear in a Cyprus court on the suspicion of making a false complaint. Police in Cyprus have released seven Israeli tourists, well, they're actually army cadets, I believe, Martin, weren't they, from detention, and said a British teenager who accused them of gang rape would face court on suspicion of making a false allegation. All seven Israelis have been released since 10 a.m, a police spokesman said. The young woman will be taken to court tomorrow morning. Earlier, a police source says the British teenager had been arrested on charges of giving a false statement over an imaginary offence. A 19-year-old woman had alleged that 12 Israelis had gang raped her at the hotel where she was staying, the resort of Ayia Napa, on 17th of July. The young Israelis were remanded wanted in custody the next day, but hours after, before their second appearance in court, five were released and sent home late on Thursday. The remaining seven had their remand order renewed on Friday for another 6 days. None have been charged. Both hearings took place behind closed doors because the suspects were minors.
Well, what can you say? I mean, it either happened or it didn't, and there's not much point speculating about what happened because we don't know. The police in Cyprus have got to do their job objectively if they can.
So there is not a lot of reporting of that case, a little bit from here and there, I suppose. Anyhow, let's have it move on now to have a look at the... I actually did an interview with Anton Chaitkin, which is going to be on Dialect on Tuesday, and I thought we'd have a listen to some of the little bits and pieces of that today. Now, this is actually one little excerpt, and this is one about what he believes is... I mean, here he is talking about this whole idea of progress. Is humanity progressing? And if not, who's trying to stop it?
What the public misses is that this all depends on the public itself being demoralized. When there is leadership, as we had in the United States at certain times, such as in the recent memory, Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy, and before that, a couple of times in our history, not only was there great progress made, and this also occurred in other places, like under Bismarck in Germany and so forth. But whenever you have this kind of leadership, the public expression of intelligence, of thinking, of an emotion beyond self-interest and beyond greed, makes progress unstoppable.
So Marty's talking there about sort of, I suppose the idea really is that the oligarchy actually want to stop progress because they want to dominate and monopolise existing markets.
Well, that's true. I mean, Michael Hudson in the US is very good on this. He's an economist, and he's pointing out in the progressive era in the US, which is the early 1900s, it was across the spectrum. There was an understanding that landowners and speculators and others, who basically what's called economic rent in economic textbooks, are unproductive. And ultimately, you've got to tax those the ill-gotten gains they make, and you use that to fund your social services.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open, and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU settlement scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Back to the US and Trump, Martin, talking about Baltimore. Now, this is, again, he's being accused of racism. But is he correct that it's a rat-infested city? I mean, surely that's just a fact.
Well, I mean, there are supposedly more rats than people in Britain, and I used to have some in my bedsit not long ago. So, yeah, they're all around us, aren't they, the rats?
So, if he says that Baltimore is a rat-infested place, is that? I mean, he's also saying it's corrupt. Elijah Cummings is corrupt mayor of Baltimore.
Yeah,
well,
one of the things about this, and I read quite a lot of right-wing US stuff on the internet, is that they're going on about how the big cities are full of crime. And you feel like saying, yes, because that's where all the poor people live. And if you live in a comfortable suburb, it's not so crime-ridden. What's the surprise?
So really, Trump is attacking poverty rather than race.
Well, yeah, but, you know, he's making specific allegations of corruption against the political leadership in Baltimore. That may or may not be true. But when he compared it to Honduras, I thought was very interesting, because under the previous Obama administration, a coup was carried out in Honduras against Zelaya, who was the left-wing president, And they've now got a pro-US regime in power. There's massive demonstrations to try and kick them out. Huge demonstration we hear nothing about. We're hearing about Hong Kong. We heard about the Gilets Jaunes, but we're not really hearing about what's going on in Honduras. And Honduras is a mess because the US has dominated its politics for over 100 years. And they've basically made damn sure that the powerful in Honduras, the landowners, the people with money, are still in power. And anybody who tries to turn that over is driven out of the country like Zelaya has been. And that's why it's a mess, because the Americans have made it a mess, just like they've made Haiti a mess.
Okay,
just like they've made loads of other places a mess, and then they go, what a mess those countries are. You made it.
To Baltimore, too bad. Trump reacts to the burglary at Cummings' Baltimore home after a week of attacks. That's just today on CNN. President Donald Trump has appeared to sarcastically call out a break-in at Republican Elijah Cummings' Baltimore home after a week of attacking the prominent African-American lawmaker over the conditions of his Baltimore district, even comparing the city's murder rate to third world countries. Really bad news. The Baltimore house of Elijah Cummings was robbed. Too bad, the president tweeted today.
Well, that's just belligerent beyond belief, isn't it? This isn't a rational conversation about anything. It's just a lot of mudslinging. And, of course, fundamentally underlying all of this is that since the Reagan Revolution in the United States of America, poor people have gone backwards, backwards, backwards. We're talking about progress. There's been no progress. There's been no raise of ordinary wages in the US for decades. And that's because of policy pursued from Washington to keep the poor down and to keep the wealthy in the style to which they've become accustomed.
There is also a history in the US, isn't there, and in this country actually, of deliberate targeting of politicians' homes by criminals, by the mob. In many cases.
Well,
even by intelligence services.
Well, you know, we don't know what's happened here, who's carried out this particular incident, so it's silly to speculate. But of course, the real problem is that the inner city in America is a hellish place to live. Look at Detroit. There's a brilliant documentary about Detroit, came out a few years ago. Absolutely devastated by the housing crash of 2008 and everything else. And that's all policy decided in Wall Street and implemented by Washington. And poor people are on the receiving end of it. Well, and then they get the blame for being poor.
Well, this whole thing of deindustrialisation we'll be looking at on Tuesday on Dialect at noon with Steve McHenry and Anton Chaitkin. We'll be hearing more from Anton on Tuesday. And looking at the background to why it is actually much more difficult to get a job now, both in the US and in Britain, because back in the 1970s, you could take your O-levels up to Filton and get a job straight away. Quite an easy place to get some work in the aerospace industry, which is pretty not, well, not, doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, on to the Jeffrey Epstein case, Martin, because this is has implications in a way for what we were hearing from Mark Watts in the first hour. This whole thing of child sexual abuse, where it does seem as if Epstein was involved in a military style or intelligence operation in order to get basically cases on specific individuals that could then be used for blackmail in politics.
Well, that's what we're saying in the first hour, and it's pretty clear that he is an intelligence operative. Ghislaine Maxwell, who was his main procuress, she used to find the girls for him. She was definitely a Mossad agent, as was Robert Maxwell, her father. And the Epstein case is probably blackmail by Mossad. I'm not saying I can prove that, but that's pretty much what it looks like.
Well, let's have a listen now to one of the legal people working on the case or involved in the case. I think she's a lawyer, actually, talking about why there will be no trial for a while. We're going to have to wait at least a year until Epstein is put on trial.
It appears that Mr. Epstein's trial will not take place until next year. There are a number of motions that have to be filed. The defense was indicating that it is going to make motions having to do with what they allege was a non-prosecution agreement, and they also allege that there are complex constitutional issues involved in this case.
Well, it may well be that Epstein, I mean, apparently he tried to commit suicide. It may well be that he's never going to go on trial because he knows too much. And he may have to, some people might want him to be eliminated so that the trial never takes place.
He certainly does know a lot, doesn't he? And it would be very interesting to see what he's got to say in court in his own defence as to who's put him up to this stuff. But, I mean, what about the idea that the case is too complicated constitutionally. I mean, it does seem, doesn't it, that people who are rich and powerful get treated by the justice system very differently. There's a lot of time now for the lawyers to consider arguments a whole year, and obviously to be paid during that time while they're doing that, and the case is going to take a long time to actually come to court, if ever, like you say.
Well, Maya Lansky, who used to head up the mafia in in the US, he basically used various people who were connected to the Epstein case in the past, or people like him, to, you know, they got stuff on J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI. He apparently liked little boys, so they got photographs of him doing stuff with little boys, and then, of course, he does everything they want.
I think he was called Gay Edgar Hoover, by some.
Well, indeed, and the point is that it was all illegal in those days, so they could easily blackmail people if they had homosexual tendencies and so on. And intelligence agencies do stuff like that. Money, ideology, coercion, ego. The four ways of getting people to do what you want.
Epstein, the Guardian reports yesterday, reportedly hoped to develop a super race of humans with his own DNA. Registered sex offender hopes to seed a human race with his, the human race, with his DNA by impregnating 20 women at a time, the New York Times is reporting. The wealthy financier accused of sex trafficking planned to develop an improved super race of humans using genetic engineering and artificial intelligence.
Well, I mean, there's more to this case than we know, but the idea that intelligence services, including Mossad, use blackmail as a tool should hardly be news to people listening to this show. It's an obvious thing to point out, isn't it?
Though there's little evidence that Epstein's scheme ever progressed beyond fantasy, prominent scientists, including the late Stephen Hawking, regularly attended dinners, lunches and conferences held by Epstein, the Times has said, New York Times that is. Epstein has long been accused of sexually abusing underage girls. He also had purported connections with Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, Prince Andrew, and moved in elite social circles in New York, Florida and elsewhere. He's currently in jail after being arrested on the 6th of July, and he pleaded not guilty several weeks ago. Now, this whole master race thing sounds like eugenics to me.
Well, of course it is. I mean, he's actually built, on his island, he's built a model of a Mamluk hammam, which is a bathhouse from Syria. And if you think about it, and why, it's like a temple on his island. And, of course, there's a kind of occult dimension to all of this, like Skull and Bones, which we heard about in the very beginning. And this is how the elite conducts its operations. So they get them involved in very secret organisations, they get them compromised, and then even if they had goodwill, they can't do anything because they're going to have to do as they're told. And that's the way it's always run, and it's very difficult for law enforcement to do anything about it because they're often paid off themselves.
I mean, it does seem like this could be part of the end of the American empire, this case, if it does actually come to court and we see that he's been involved with a whole load of, VIP paedophiles, just like we've had the inquiry here, which seems to be kicking it into the long grass in Britain, but the Americans seem to be going for some kind of justice.
Well, apart from the fact that they've just kicked it another year down the line, and who knows, we might be at war with Iran by then, and things will have changed, and we might have martial law in the US. Who knows? I think the links of the Epstein with Mossad are the thing that people need to think about, because they have got an interest in trying to steer US politics in the direction they want it to go. So they've definitely got an interest in trying to blackmail all of those people that you've mentioned.
Well, the good old US of A, of course, back when the September the 11th attacks happened, decided that they discovered a guy called Osama bin Laden. Whether he was responsible for it or not, it didn't seem to matter, but he was in a cave in Bora Bora, Afghanistan, and so the United States and NATO invaded Afghanistan. They're still there, and we hear this week, Martin, that actually the invading forces, the occupying forces of NATO, are now killing more people, or innocent people, civilians, than the Taliban are. So, I mean, why, if we would, obviously the local people are thinking, well, if those NATO people go away, our life will get better.
Well, there's talks being mediated by the Russians to try and get the Taliban and the Americans to discuss the possibility of ending the war. And, of course, that's how all of these wars end, if they ever end, is through some kind of negotiation, just like in Chechnya, just like in the Six Counties. And, the Helmand province, for example, where the British were, is now 100% under Taliban control, as it was always going to be, because it was their heartland. They're the local boys, and they speak the local language, and you're not going to beat them with boys from the Mersey and the Thames and the Tyne.
Meanwhile, in Syria, there's a ceasefire with the rebel-dominated Idlib. So we've been hearing reports about all the dreadful things that are going to happen to civilians in Idlib. But the Russians, I think without the Americans involved here, am I right, Martin? I think it's been taking place in Kazakhstan. I think the peace talks have been taking place. So there is some good news, I suppose, at last, about Syria. The ceasefire has been reached with the rebel-dominated forces in Idlib. The deal aims to end around 3 months of fighting. Syrian state media has reported they've reached a conditional ceasefire deal in the Idlib province, a move which would end about 3 months of back-and-forth offensives between the military and the al-Qaeda-dominated rebels. The government says the ceasefire is conditional on the rebels moving 20 kilometres away. So at least this is the last major city at war in Syria, isn't it?
The war in Syria has taken so long because the Syrian army have basically tried to negotiate with people rather than just going in there and killing them all, which of course is very destructive to the civilian population. That's why it's taken them so long to achieve.
Sounds very different to what's been going on in Afghanistan, doesn't it? You
saw Trump's remark the other week, which I thought was grotesque, that he could end the war in Afghanistan immediately by killing 10 million people, presumably he means by dropping nuclear weapons on Afghanistan. At that point, he might come up against Putin saying, if you use nuclear, that's what the Russians said, if you use nuclear weapons on anybody, we're going to nuke you. So he doesn't seem to have taken that one on board. But anyway, what a crass thing to say. We could win the war by killing 10 million people in a week. Absurd.
Martin, you shared with me quite an interesting article during the week about Sudan, didn't you? About the Americans in South Sudan having for a long, long time actually been dominant there. We don't hear much about AFRICOM, which is the Pentagon's control of Africa branch based in Stuttgart, but we're going to hear a little bit maybe later about that. But this is actually quite an important aspect to this war in Sudan, and the fact that the people have been fighting for the last 8 months for some sort of democracy, well, actually for many years, but on the streets of Khartoum. And actually the United States has been massively involved in that, although we haven't heard much about that on the news.
Well, the United States wants the current regime in Sudan overthrown, and therefore they are behind the protesters. The protesters have got their own legitimate reasons for wanting that regime to go. I think what was interesting about the article that I sent you is that John Garang, who used to lead the SPLA, which was the Sudanese separatist movement, he signed a deal with Omar Bashir, who's the head of the Sudanese military and the president, and he said, we don't want to be independent of Sudan, we want autonomy, but we want, because we've got oil here, and the Chinese basically developed an oil industry, and we were prepared to share that with everybody else in Sudan. But then, of course, rebels broke away from his movement and started an internal fight to stop him doing what he wanted to do. And, of course, that's manipulation by outside forces. They want to break Sudan up, they don't want the Chinese to have the oil facilities down there, and the Americans have got their finger in the pie.
Last year I spoke to the editor of the Smoke and Mirrors blog, one of my favourite blogs in the world. If you read German, it's great, but if you don't, it's fine, because you can get your internet browser to translate it into English. His blog is called All Smoke and Mirrors. His name is Manfred Petrisch, and I asked him last year, this is a part of a longer interview, about AFRICOM. This is this United States Institute of the Pentagon, based in Stuttgart in Germany, which is attempting to dominate the whole of Africa.
I'm sorry, I have to completely destroy your illusions.
He's just talking about Switzerland.
First of all, Switzerland is not a safe haven. Secondly, our politicians in Switzerland are exactly the same traitors like in all the EU countries. They would sell Switzerland to Brussels in 5 minutes if they could. And that's why our head of parliament, the president of the Swiss parliament, was in Dresden at the Bilderberg meeting. I also talked to her for 2 hours after the meeting. That means, you see, for me, when the Bilderberg meeting in 2011 was in Switzerland, I realized by watching what was happening and organizing the protests there that we have lost the game. We have lost the game. And that the politicians have nothing to say. They have nothing to say. They're all controlled by the big, huge corporations. And we have the problem that they have all the power. They own the military, they own the media, they own the police, they own the judges, they own the all the powers that you need. And we on the other side, we own nothing. So we have lost. And also that there is this absolutely hysterical drive to make war with Russia. I mean, we see this in the last years, how they have been bashing Russia and Putin like hell. And they also moved all their troops and their weapons towards the Russian border. They have now installed this so-called anti-ballistic rocket system in Romania, which they're telling us are against rockets of Iran and North Korea, which is a laugh. Now, you said before that I moved into an area which could be a potential target. No. The potential target is Europe. Europe will be flattened in a future war. Not Russia or America. Europe will be flattened again. And I tell this to all my German friends. I tell them, do you realize that because of all the American military bases there, all the command centers in Germany, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, and all these bases, and also that you have atomic weapons stored in Germany, that you are a prime target for a war? That the first thing that will be hit is Germany? Because that's where all the Americans have their bases. And all wars come from German territory.
CENTCOM and AFRICOM, what are they and where are they based? We don't hear about them in the news.
Well, that doesn't mean they don't exist. I mean, CENTCOM and AFRICOM, for instance, the center is in Stuttgart. That's the command center for all the military operations which are done in Africa and in the Middle East. It's all controlled from Stuttgart. The big military base there and command center there. The same applies to, for instance, Rammstein. From Rammstein, all the killer drones are controlled, which fly over Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and North Africa, wherever they fly around and kill people. They're all controlled from Rammstein, this huge Air Force base there. And Wiesbaden is the big European military central command. You see, there are over 70,000 American troops based in Germany. 70,000 American soldiers occupying Germany. That's the most occupying force in the whole of the world. Well, more than in Japan or more than in South Korea.
Well, I mean, that's a fairly clear indication of Manfred's views about what's going on.
What about the point he's making there about Germany actually being a target because of all these military bases?
Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? If you're going to have all those bases there and the balloon goes up, you're going to be in the thick of it, aren't you? What we really need is withdrawal of all foreign forces from Europe. And a reimagining of our relationship with democratic Russia, and everybody concentrating on, trying to make things better. But we're a long way from that at this moment, aren't we?
Okay, but with Boris Johnson in charge here, do you think there's likely to be a different flavour in the relationship than there was with Theresa May, bearing in mind, of course, that her husband was this sort of major figure in US finance?
Well, they're all part of a globalised elite with their own agenda. I think the problem for Boris Johnson coming back down to the sort of kindergarten level is that he's got various problems holding the UK together, trying to get some kind of deal with the EU. And, of course, the Americans could really upset the apple cart by saying we're going to go to a war with Iran, get your kit on. And well, let's see how popular that is in Brecon and Radnor.
Looking at the popular people, apparently Trump, apparently the only real challenger to Trump is Tulsi Gabbard. She dominates all the online ratings after the Democratic debates.
Well, she's being... The mainstream media are trying to shut her out. And she's blotted her copybook recently by voting for this.
Who is she?
Well, Tulsi Gabbard is a congresswoman from Hawaii, and she's also a military veteran. She served in Iraq as a doctor. She's of Hindu origin, and she's very, very anti-war as an ex-military person. I mean, she can stand there with her uniform on, saying, "I'm against the war."
About her, I'm just reading this on Mint Press News, is that she is challenging all these foreign policy assumptions in a very cohesive way, and she's moving the Overton window, which is meaning, basically, this is what is acceptable to think about. Yeah. That is all changing, and she's managing to move.
Well, more strength to her elbow. I mean, I hope she's... What I can see happening, possibly happening, is that if she does very well in the primaries, and we haven't had any voting yet, she can actually... either A, be the candidate, or B, be the vice presidential candidate if somebody else is stronger than she is, maybe Bernie Sanders. But she would definitely be my vote for US president, although she's blotted her copybook, as I say, recently. She's gone along with the Democratic majority in the Congress saying that nobody's allowed to argue in favour of boycotting Israel, because Israel apparently is untouchable. And she's tried to finesse that. There was only a very small minority who voted against it, but she wasn't one of them, which is very unfortunate, I'm afraid.
Will she be booted out like Bernie Sanders was?
What's already happening is that an attempt by the mainstream media to marginalise her or make her sound as if she's a nutcase and all the rest of it. But she has got one of the things she's done, which many, many mainstream politicians in the US have never done, she's actually served in the military in a war zone.
Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Independent Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey. Also, you just heard there, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also to Mark Watts, a freelance journalist in the first hour. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car, the iPlayer, anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy Quain, Saturday edition at 10 a.m. tomorrow. And Bristol's Best Kept Musical Secret, Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Our sister show, Dialects, here next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the